You're listening to the Ardent Development Podcast with Ron Smith and Derek Hatchard. Whatever your role in the software development industry, join them in the search for inspiration and insights as they talk with practitioners and thought leaders from the world of tech and beyond. Visit ardentdev.com to subscribe to new episodes.
Welcome to the Ardent Development Podcast. I'm Ron Smith.
And I'm Derek Hatchard, and today we are speaking with Adam Englander. Adam is a software architect with a passion for developing secure and maintainable software. He is the founder of PHP Vegas and truly loves supporting the local and global developer communities. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you. Good morning.
Now, your mission, as I understand it, is to help developers build secure applications. So through, you know, with cryptography and continuous testing, is that a fair characterization?
That's what I've been working on this year. It's been something that I kind of came up with this year, finding that a lot of developers don't even understand security. With a lot of what's going on right now in the world, basically, with all of these hacks going on and people's information being kind of spread upon the world, just trying to help your average developer understand what their role is in that and what they can do to protect their users and kind of the whole web ecosystem.
Was that really intentional, or was it emergent, you know, based on things that you had worked on before and things that you were interested in?
It happened in part when I started working for Iovation. At the time, it was a smaller company, LaunchKey. And I learned so many things that I never knew as a developer working at a security company. I learned that you're constantly being probed and people are constantly looking to see if you're vulnerable. Some of them are good people that are just trying to tell the world, hey, 23% of the world has this bad version of Nginx or something. But there are a lot of people out there that are just attempting to see where they can access, what they can access. And I had no idea that was going on. I thought, you know, you need to be a target. You need to have something valuable for people to come after you and for people to try and attack you. And that's just not the case. I also didn't understand how much a single set of credentials can mean. Most people share passwords. So if I have, you know, I have some crazy blog site, that has nothing of real value, but you need to be able to log in to make comments, you may use the same credentials that you use to log into your bank. And that's what criminals are after. They're after credentials because the likelihood that you've used it for getting your email account or getting into your bank it's highly possible. So my little WordPress site that means nothing to anyone, maybe it's probably a target. And it may have something that's extremely valuable to these people that are commenting on my website, which is credentials to their bank accounts. So in discovering that, I had been doing presentations on some other passions of mine at conferences, which is testing. It's another big one. And decided I would start submitting things more security basis to try and help the average individual developer better understand how cryptography works, what it's used for, what things they need to be aware of and afraid of, and how to protect themselves.
We run WordPress for the website for this podcast, and I was actually quite surprised when I looked the other day at how many infiltration attacks had been prevented by the software that we were running in front of it. It was really surprising for a brand new site, yeah, that doesn't have household name recognition. Today, we're going to talk specifically about biometrics. A lot of our listeners are going to be familiar with two-factor authentication. So, you know, to get money from my bank machine, you know, I have to possess something, my bank card, and I have to know something, my PIN. Or, you know, to get into my work account, I need a password, and I need some kind of a time-based one-time password from a token generator, or I get a code sent to me by a text message. Help us understand what a biometric factor is for authentication.
Sure. A biometric factor is something that is unique to your body. So it's going to be, people are pretty familiar with fingerprints. Selfie login has got a lot of press about 6 months ago when some of the banks were trying it out. Just log in with your face. Face ID on the iPhone is a big one. Most of your high-end or kind of mid-range now, I guess, mobile devices will let you use your fingerprint to log into the mobile device. There's other pieces too, which are kind of behavior biometrics, how you type, how you speak, as well as there's voice recognition and iris scans and things like that. They've been around for, I guess, fingerprints have been around for thousands of years. The retina scans have been around, or the iris scans have been around for at least 50 years. But it's really just starting to, the hardware to process that inexpensively is just now become available.
We've seen, you know, handprint and fingerprint scanners and voice recognition and eye scanners and all kinds of things. I mean, you know, Star Trek was doing this in their storylines years and years ago. We've seen this for decades. So we're really, I think many of us are conditioned to expect that these things are going to come at some point. But there are pitfalls, right? What are the things that can go wrong? Or what are the things that I need to do to make sure that my app or my company is really secure when biometrics are in the equation?
Biometrics by themselves really aren't enough. Multi-factor authentication is using three factors, which is something you possess. So whether it's a mobile device, Bluetooth device, a key, a card, something like that. Something that you know, which would be some sort of a PIN or a password, and something that you are, which is a biometric. Because by themselves, they aren't terribly effective, because all the sci-fi movies you see, or especially a lot of the action movies you see, right, they manage to get someone's eye, or they cut off someone's finger, or they get your fingerprint from a glass or something like that. And when you have all of these things, there are things that you can do to protect that. So if they just get one piece, they're not going to have the other. If they just get your password, they don't have your fingerprint. If they get your fingerprint, they don't have your password, they might not have something you possess. To truly protect a system, when someone needs to authenticate to it, having all three factors is a huge, huge help. Biometrics on their own is something uniquely interesting, because if you were to lose, let's say you have an RSA token for work and you lose that, well, great. You can just disassociate that RSA token from your account. If you've got a YubiKey that you're using for GitHub or something like that, you can just disassociate the YubiKey once you notice that it's missing. If you think your password might be compromised, you can change your password. Someone gets your biometric, you can't change that. You can't disassociate that with you, because it's inherently you. So that's the good side of it. The good side is it's inherently you. The bad part about it is that if someone gets enough information to recreate that, you can never change it. So there's a very special little Pandora's box that comes with biometrics. So there's a few ways that you can protect that. One of the ways that you can, way that I prefer to do that, is that you don't store it in a central data store. So if you're going to be, when you look at your phone and you're logging into your phone with your thumbprint, you're not actually sending that to Apple or to Google or to Samsung. It's processing that local on the device. And when it processes it local on the device, it's stored there. It's not, you can't verify that it's actually this individual, which is one of the main arguments you get for decentralized storage, is that, well, I don't have a fingerprint for you that you gave to me, so I can't verify it's the same fingerprint. But what my argument to that is that on my phone, if you're going to use the fingerprint from my phone, which a lot of apps are starting to do, you can't verify that it's me, but it's my device and I linked it to my account through other means that only I would know, or only that I should be able to do. And if someone else is accessing that, I've absolutely given them the ability to access it. So I have like emergency. So my wife is on my phone in case she has a fingerprint there, in case something happens and I need to get my phone open. You know, I'm in the hospital or whatever, and I need something off my phone. We can get that information off with her fingerprint, which means that she could also, you know, log into my bank account as me, theoretically, with the ability to do that. But the trade-offs to that are, if you store biometrics centrally, you have this giant store of biometrics. So if you want to get a million people's biometrics with decentralized storage, you'd have to go get a million phones to get a million people's fingerprints. But if you store that centrally, then I can just go to one place, hack one system, and get a million fingerprints. So I think the most secure way to do it absolutely is decentralized. Now, if there's things that you can't necessarily do that with, and one of the things that a lot of people are doing with that is they're doing voice recognition for call centers. So if you have to call in for support, they're having you, you know, say a passphrase or recite something to check your voice. Or the banks with the selfie login, that's a centralized picture of you that they're verifying against. Now, one way that you can protect those, if you can't do decentralized and you're doing a centralized storage, is that you would store it with something that is only known to the user. So basically, I would have to use a password or a passphrase or a PIN that would get added to the encryption of the biometrics stored in the data store, so that even the company, you know, if let's say I've got Bank of America, I'm using SelfieScan. If I use SelfieScan with a password, that even Bank of America can't decrypt my face for my facial recognition. It requires me to do that. So if an attacker gets that, it gives you a little more safety. But another big problem with centralized biometrics that doesn't get talked about a lot is, again, You can't disassociate it from you. I can't change my fingerprint. I can't change my iris. If it were to get stolen, a database of things get stolen, and it's happened already. So the Office of Personnel Management got hacked 2 or 3 years ago, where they took the fingerprints from everyone who applied for in the U.S. for secret or better status with the military. So if you're a military contractor, if you're writing software for the military, if you're just doing any business with the government, you have to have a background check for certain things. And a lot of those, if you're getting high enough level clearance, they'll start interviewing and acquiring data from your family members, your friends, the people you've worked with before. And all of the fingerprints for all those people were leaked in a hack. So problem with that being, that's where they actually got them. They weren't properly stored. That's problematic. But even if you were to properly store it with the strongest encryption that exists today, in 20 years, you'll be able to crack that on a phone. So the way cryptography has been working, things that were perfectly acceptable 20 years ago, right? A password could have been hashed with 20 years ago with MD5, and you'd have thought, that's fantastic security. Today, you can crack that on a television with MD5. With a phone, you can absolutely do a SHA-2 with even with a random salt, you can crack that in almost no time at all. Where a biometric that is stored with the best encryption possible today could be brute forced in 20 years. So, and the fact that your biometric sticks around, the fact that you're still going to be using the same one 20 years from now, creates a very special horror story if that ever gets leaked.
And when it comes to how you store the data, let me just caveat this. This is an area that I do not know much about, which is one of the reasons why I was so excited to talk with you, Adam. Are there standards for how this data is stored so that if it is encrypted and that encryption is brute force in the future, the data that comes back, is it in a standard data structure that then makes it reusable in other contexts? Or are people really inventing the way that they encode biometric data on a case-by-case basis?
It really just comes down to that. For fingerprints and for irises, they're taking maps and they're mapping points. And it's the same thing for fingerprints. I'm not as familiar with facial scan or iris scan, and that's different technology, but the format it's being stored in. Even for the new 3D stuff for the iPhone, it's being stored in a particular format, and it's just I'm storing points, and it's just a number of points, and you just have to be able to recreate that for the device that's being used on. So fingerprints, there are specific points and swirls and things like that. They talk about the alleles. And so they'll map those out and you'll try and, because you can never get it exactly right, because your pressure or your finger on the phone and things like that. And so they'll say, oh, yes, this is close enough to these points. Yes, this is the same person. And that's how you do that is very well known. And the format for storing those is fairly standard. That you're just storing data points.
Which makes it almost terrifying to think that the data can sit. If it sits for, like you said, because it doesn't change and it sits for a couple of decades and it becomes trivial to brute force that encryption at some point in the future, that's my same fingerprint.
Again, which is why multi-factor is so important. And the problem you have is to make it even strong, like where you use the strongest possible encryption and you're using the passwords to even make it safer. The problem is that people don't want to use the password, right? They're doing selfie login because they don't want to have to type anything. There are so many things that I have for convenience today so that I can get into something without having to make it difficult. Being a security professional, I'm one of those people that will add a little difficulty to my life. So, I do multi-factor authentication. I could very easily just make it so that, whenever I log in, I just swipe up on my phone and I'm into my systems. But I choose to, put on a PIN and all those types of things to make sure that I have all three factors. I think what you see today is that people don't want passwords. And so all of these apps that are using the fingerprint to log into your bank, to log into whatever account you might have just using your thumbprint are really showing that people just want the easiest way to get in. And they're going to refuse something that makes it more difficult. I work for a multi-factor authentication company. We see that all the time, is that we're trying to find how can you make it more secure without the user having to have any interaction? So for us, that's adding the ability to do Bluetooth. So if you have a Bluetooth headset, if you have a Bluetooth watch, you can link with that. There's another factor. So if someone steals your phone, they've got to steal your headphones and your watch or something like that. But again, the user doesn't have to interact. And that's really the tough part there is finding a way to do that in such a way that you can make it easy for the user. So the most acceptable way to do that is input from the user so that only the user could do that. And the users just don't want to do that.
I know the company that I used to work for, we went from RSA tokens to an authenticator app to a version of the app that would it would text you, and all you had to do, not text you, would do a push message in the app, the authenticator app. All you had to do then was accept, and it became this just a reduced bar for how much effort the user had to put into it, and it was amazing how much more readily people accepted that, just that change in experience. Going from 4 seconds to 2 seconds or 4 seconds to 1 second made such a huge difference in terms of the user experience. And I heard someone just this week, they're kind of lamenting the proliferation of passwords in their life and saying, like, man, when I was a kid, I didn't have to remember passwords. Adults didn't have to used to remember dozens of passwords. This is ridiculous. and I just laughed because it's a real problem. Users don't want to. I find it personally just a little bit terrifying, how little the average person really understands about the risks associated with low friction ways to get into sensitive systems.
And I think they're also just finding the problem there is with passwords too. I think in the last 6 months, I've started to see the whole, hi, we've been breached, champ, change your password. Oh, and change the password on every other site that has the same password. Mm-hmm. Because no one ever alerted you to that, and I never thought of it. Right before I started working for a company that deals with this all day long, it never even crossed my mind. Like I separated, I had categories of passwords. I'd have normal password and then my email password and then my financial password, and they were separate. But if you got my email password, you could always reset anything else you wanted. When Yahoo, when they got breached, right? If they had that password, they could go reset my bank account, because what are they going to do? They're going to send me an email and have me click on to confirm and change my password.
Hey, this is Derek and Ron. Just taking a quick break from the interview to let you know how you can support the show. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. We've both been Audible members for a long time. Ron, do you have a book to recommend this week?
Yes, I do. I want to recommend The 17 Essential Qualities of a Team Player by John C. Maxwell. I've read the book personally multiple times. This is a must read if you are trying to become a better team player, or if you're working with teams and you're trying to evolve them.
You can download this week's recommendation or pick another audiobook for free and support this podcast at the same time by visiting ardentdev.com/audible. That's ardentdev.com/audible. And now back to the interview.
So Adam, where do you see the pendulum swinging then? Because so if we stick with the traditional password or even multi-factor authentication with just passwords, it's all temporary, right? Those passwords can be changed. If we stay with the biometrics the way everyone wants for convenience, this you're painting this terrible picture that at some point they'll become crackable anyway, or they maybe already are. Where do you see, this moving to? Because it doesn't sound like a very good solution either way.
Well, what I've seen and what people are asking for our multi-factor authentication solution is what they want to do is they want to reduce friction until there's a point where you have an additional risk. So I think you're seeing it a lot in some of your more advanced online retailers. So if I go and I start adding things to my shopping cart in Amazon, it doesn't ask me for my password. I'm logged in. It doesn't care. But if I try and actually purchase something, I try and check out and use an existing stored card, it's going to have me authenticate again. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that going on. There's also a lot trying to determine what is the risk of the device that's being used. So one of the things that our company also provides, and one of the reasons that when we were acquired, it was such a fan, I was a part of a company that just did multi-factor authentication and was acquired by a fraud company. And the reason for that was is that it's such a great marriage, because people want to be able to say, great, I don't want to make it difficult unless there's risk. And I want to be able to increase the difficulty based on risk. So if you're doing something that I don't care about, I'm willing to take, if something goes wrong, I'm willing to take the hit. I'm not even going to bother having you log in if I've seen this device before and you've used it to log in and I trust it. But if you get on a new device, I'm going to have you authenticate, because that's a risk. This is a device I've never seen before that you're not associated with. So I have no guarantee or even just idea that this might be you. This could be someone trying to attack. Mm-hmm. If it's coming from a region based on IP where you've never logged in before. That's a higher risk. So you want to take in together all these factors and use this wonderful AI and machine learning stuff that we're all talking about all the time, and use that to determine how risky is this interaction with you, and then make you step up based on that. So if it's something where it's like, oh, well, this is just, you know, they're accessing something, but there's no, you know, super secret information, or they're not going to be able to do a fund transfer or anything money related. Great. I'm not going to make you put in a PIN and a fingerprint. I'll just make you use your fingerprint. But if you want to make a purchase or add a new card or transfer money or something like that, well, I'm going to require that you have all three factors because this is a high risk situation. I've never seen this device before. You're trying to move money. This could be problematic. So I think where things are going is they're going to be going to more of a risk-based analysis on how many factors and what you need to do. So that helps you reduce a lot of the friction with the, I only have to really get serious about auth until, you know, when I'm doing something that's going to be detrimental, it could be detrimental. And I think most people understand that. I think the other thing too is that I hope that everything starts moving to the decentralized store and they start understanding, look, you know, they start weighing the risk and the reward. Because you hear people a lot of times, and this is the argument that I get when I talk about this stuff at security conferences, is that phones aren't as secure as the systems that we can make, you know, in the central data store. And I absolutely agree with that, you know, especially when you're talking about, you know, Android devices, because of their nature of not having the software and the hardware written together, that you get with like an iPhone or a BlackBerry, or even sometimes some of the Microsoft devices after they bought Nokia. The thing there is that if you want me to, if you want to make a target enough attack to where you're going to get all the information you need for me to be able to get into my device, hacking into an iPhone is very difficult. Hacking into an Android device is pretty difficult. It's easier for you just to compel me in some way, whether it's blackmail or coercion or whatever it might be, to just get me to log in. So the likelihood that they would do that is probably higher than them just trying to take your device and go unnoticed, because that's going to be very difficult. I argue that a target attack, if you're going to make a target attack, that's going to have to be a fairly high-profile target or someone who has access, you know, who is in the ring of a high-profile target. It's a lot of work to individually attack people, and you have to know exactly what you're going after. So because of the amount of time and risk involved, there's going to have to be a payoff, where when you go towards a centralized data store, all you're hoping is that, you know, maybe 1% will pay off, because, you know, there's a lot less risk. You're not, you know, when you go grab someone's data and you hide your tracks on how you got that data, the risk associated with that is fairly low compared to I'm going to go steal someone's phone with cameras everywhere in our society today and people around. It's a very, very, very risky situation. So I argue that, you know, the decentralized store, although each individual piece is less secure than it could be inside of a centralized and hardened environment, together, when you add it all up, it is way more secure, because if I get attacked, you haven't been attacked.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. I live in a very small city, and I feel much safer with my phone is one of the safest digital assets I have, because it sits with me in this very small community. Whereas I've got a lot of other data that sits out on the internet waiting for anybody anywhere in the world to try to poke into it. So that makes a lot of sense, what you're saying. Maybe, Adam, before we let you go, it might be helpful just if you could explain briefly what it is that your company does. I know that you offer multi-factor authentication solutions. You have, I think, fraud detection. Maybe just give us the quick elevator pitch.
Sure. We provide products on two basic lines. One of those is fraud detection. We have a very large conglomerate of companies, very big name companies, that we have billions of devices that have been utilized. And we do a device fingerprint on those devices so that we can say that, oh, great. So you went to store X and you made a purchase and they said it wasn't fraudulent. So the likelihood that when you come to my online presence and you try and use that same device, there's a decent possibility that you're not fraudulent. And even more so on the other side, is that when someone reports that device as being fraudulent, we're going to say, hey, this device has been used for fraudulent stuff. You should be very wary. The other piece that we have is we have different authentication mechanisms. One is that uses that device ID to be able to determine if the user has logged in from this device before. And if they have, again, if that you can make that determination if you want them to authenticate or not. And then the other piece on top of that is we have an authentication, multi-factor authentication product, which is what I work mostly on. And that allows you to integrate this functionality into your own mobile app. So as a company, you can integrate our technology into your mobile app and into your website or your kiosk or whatever it might possibly be. And you can create very strong multi-factor authentication through using our software as a service implementation.
Can you let our listeners know where they can find you online?
Sure, sure. I'm on Twitter. It's Adam_Englander. And I will tweet out every now and again. I tweet out some interesting security stuff or breach stuff that you might need to be worried about. For developers, every time there's a patch coming to one of the big languages recently there was a big one that just went out. You can follow it there. And I also end up retweeting some interesting stuff for developers from other people in the community that I have associated with.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Adam. This has been fantastic.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a little disturbing and fantastic.
Unfortunately, yeah, when you open up the blinds and you see how they make the sausage, it gets a little crazy.
You've been listening to the Ardent Development Podcast. Be sure to visit ardentdev.com for the show notes, including links to the resources mentioned. And don't forget to sign up for email notifications so you're the first to know about new episodes. You can also connect with us on the Ardent Development Facebook page or follow us on Twitter @ardentdev. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend about it. Thanks for listening.